No. Don't get up and go. Wasn't that terrific? That was the end of Persian electronic music. And now, this is the Union of Time Thieves. Where? KBOO.FM. Hit it, Zooty.
Where do I go? Follow the river. Where do I go? Follow the gulls. Where is the something? Where is the someone that tells me why I live and die?
Hi, I'm Becky, and I'm your host for today's program. I'm a member of the Union of Time Thieves, which was created to reclaim the world we all live in from the power of alienation. The Union of Time Thieves exists because we believe that most choices that occur to everybody within what is called the real world are illusory, that they stem from the need for society to constantly broker power and assign value amongst its parts. We live in a spectacular society where relationships are mediated by images. We hope to inspire others to join our cause and to demonstrate how to increase free, creative time with the goal of collaborative reclamation. Each show will focus on a theme in an exploration of storytelling, readings, music, and more through the writings and works of the Situationist International in all its forms. This month, the Union of Time Thieves brings you the Portland Center for Public Humanities at Portland State University's talk between Slavoj Žižek and Jean-Pierre Dupuy. We'll focus on Professor Žižek's talk as he has quite a bit to say, and we only have an hour. So tune in next time for Jean-Pierre Dupuy. For now, Professor Žižek. And his talk, Is God Dead, Unconscious, or Just Evil?
Let me begin with a very weird film. Probably not a lot of you saw it because it's half forgotten today. It's one of those religious Christian films called The Rapture from 1991, written and directed by Michael Tolkien, a film in which Mimi Rogers plays Sharon, a young L.A. woman who works during the day as a phone operator, endlessly repeating the same questions in a small cubicle, while in the evening she engages in orgies and so on. Bored and dissatisfied at leading such an empty life, Sharon becomes member of a sect which preaches that the end of time and rapture are imminent. So, turning into a passionate believer, she begins to practice a new pious lifestyle. She gets married with Randy, one of her previous swinging partners, and they have had a daughter, Mary. 6 years later, when Randy is shot to death by a madman, this totally meaningless Cacheron and her daughter, even more convinced that rapture is approaching. Sharon believes God told her that she should go with Mary to a nearby desert camping place and wait there until the two of them, she and her daughter, will be taken up to heaven to be reunited with Randy. Mary, the daughter, gets impatient and proposes her mother that they simply kill themselves so that they reach heaven quickly. After a couple of weeks, Sharon totally desperate, tired of waiting, decides to do this. She shoots her daughter, but then stops, doesn't shoot herself, realizing that suiciders are not allowed into heaven. But the point is not that this is a simple opportunistic fear. No, she immediately goes to the police, confesses her act, and is arrested and taken to a local jail. Now, up to this point, it can be a simple, even atheist, critical story about about how religious fanaticism ends up in disaster. We can imagine the ending, how Sharon is alone, totally broken, aware of the horror she's committed and she has committed, and so on and so on. But now the reason comes why I like the movie. At this point, totally weird things begin to happen. While she is desperate alone in the prison cell, rapture happens. The real one. Literally, in all naivety, including bad special effects. First, deep in the night, Mary, her daughter, appears to her with two angels, and then a loud trumpet blast is heard all around and prison bars fall down. She escapes the prison, runs into the desert, and sees the four horsemen running around, four horsemen of the apocalypse. I like this first reversal, because it is as if we have a brutal, ironic God who does the opposite of what we, half-believers, half-atheists, would have expected. Our expectation is something like, oh, maybe Bible is not to be taken literally. Of course, all these are ridiculous, superstitious stories. But it's just that, you know, we should look at it metaphorically, symbolically. It simply means there is some deeper spiritual truth, whatever. No, here God's message to man is something like, you read the Bible, what did you think, that I was kidding or what? No, screw your, you know, search for deeper meaning. I wrote what I plan, and here you got it now. Now comes an even weirder reversal. That's not the end. Sharon is then raptured, transported to a purgatory-like landscape. We see paradise in far distance, like some enlightened castle. Then, in a vision, Mary, her deceased daughter, approaches her and pleads with her to accept God. She said, in a very Pascalian way, it doesn't matter do you really believe or not. Just say, Jesus, I love you, or whatever, and look, we are here, me and Randy, your husband, my father, we are just gladly waiting for you. Then something incredible happens. And that's the end of the film already. Sharon simply refuses. Although, again, there is no doubt now. There is God and so on. She said that I am not ready to declare my love for God who acted with such cruelty towards my family for no reason at all. When Mary asks her mother, do you know, mother, what this means? Do you know how long you will be confined to stay here if you refuse to say to God, I love you? Sharon replies, yes, I know, forever. The end of the film. I mean, it's a totally crazy, incredible film. Why do I like it? So Sharon realizes that she wasted her life appeasing a God who is only toying with her feelings. And that's the paradox of the film. It would be very easy to accept all this if we were to discover that God doesn't exist, that Sharon was just caught into her religious imagination and delirious imagination. But the paradox is she persists in renouncing a God who is real, but a narcissist giving us life for the sole purpose of demanding unconditional love in return, no matter how much damage his demands have inflicted on human lives. Now, this is not a joke. Such indifferent and narcissistic God is part of a certain, at least Christian, tradition. For Nicolas Malebranche, a pupil of Descartes, in the same way that the saintly person uses the suffering of others to bring about his own narcissistic satisfaction, Malebranche had no illusions here, in helping those in distress, God also ultimately loves only himself. He merely uses us, our human suffering, to promulgate his own glory. So, Malbranche draw this incredible conclusion. It is not true that if Christ had not come to earth to deliver humanity, that if Christ had not come to earth to redeem us, everyone would have been lost. Quite on the contrary, nobody would have to be lost. All of us had to fall so that to give God the opportunity to come and deliver some of us. It's a very weird logic, and you find similar absolute miracles in Malebranche. For example, it's close to morbidity. For example, he said that at no point was God more happy than when he observed his son dying in pain on the cross. Okay, now back to the movie. Sharon's resistance to God, her refusal to declare her love for him, is, I would claim, an authentic ethical act. It would be totally wrong to say that she rejects the false God, and that in an authentically Christian version of the film, the true Christ should appear at the end, proclaim her a true believer precisely because she rejected to declare that she loves the false God, and so on. The true temptation to be resisted is to declare our love for a God who doesn't deserve it, even if he really is a God. Now, I confront the obvious, naive, materialist question. All this cannot but appear as a pseudotopic, a rather stupid mental experiment. Isn't this obvious? Why engage in these stupid games? Isn't it that simply for a consequent materialist? We should simply renounce God. There is no God, and not play these stupid games. God is, but he is maybe evil, not good, whatever. But I think that there is something much subtler here at work. We should, in consequent materialism, undermine, as it were, the fiction of God from within. Because if we don't do that, then this fiction can prolong its hold over us in the form of disavowal, which is almost, I'm tempted to say, the way a great majority of us continue to believe. I'm always making this experiment with all my relatives, friends. I ask them, okay, cut the crap. Do you believe in God or not? And it's absolutely incredible, sorry for this brief improvisation, what answers do I have? Like half a year ago we had in London a conference on the actuality of theological-political. And there were there some big theologists and so on. And literary theorists, others. And I did something which obviously broke all the rules of polite conversation. I asked them, listen, I'm sorry, but this is a conference on theology. Do you believe in God or not? It was incredible. They reacted as if I asked them, like, in what position did you have sex last night or what? Absolutely, one of them, I will name him, he is my good friend Eric Sentner. He said, well, I prefer not to engage in that direction because I speak here as a literary theorist. Don't mess me into that and so on. There were theologists then, leftist theologists who said, listen, that's not the point. The point is how to mobilize progressive politics today and so on and so on. So I think that far from being an exception, this is our belief today. It's even something like, I know there is no God, but he is nonetheless a noble and uplifting illusion. Some of my Jewish friends who are Zionists, even one of them openly told me another version of this paradox when we debated West Bank. He said, I know God doesn't exist, but nonetheless, he gave us West Bank. Why? Now I go into much more serious waters. You can imagine what I will try to prove in a bloody very serious way. I'm not kidding. I consider myself an atheist, but only through Christianity can you really be an atheist. You have to go through Christian experience. If not, then you don't believe it. But the fiction persists, determines you. How? Let me do now something for which I really hate myself, but it's necessary here. Let me repeat an old joke which I used, I would say at least a conservative estimate, some 15 to 20 times in my work. So it's an old joke, you are not obliged to laugh, but its structure is wonderful. You know, that classical joke about an idiot who believes he is a grain of seed and it's finally cured in the lunatic asylum, is left out and comes running back, and his psychiatrist asks him, but why? Why are you so frightened? Why do you come back? The guy says, well, I met a chicken and I was afraid the chicken will eat me, no? And the doctor, the psychiatrist says, but wait a minute, we cured you. You know that you are not a grain of corn or whatever. And he says, yes, I know it now, but does the chicken know it also? This is how we believe today. Another story which I used only 5 times in my book, so I can tell it to you. The one you mentioned, quantum physics, we all admire. He was a true genius, much more than Heisenberg, who got it wrong with that uncertainty principle, Niels Bohr. You know, there is a wonderful anecdote about him. He had a small wooden house somewhere in suburbs around Copenhagen, and at the entrance of that house there was a horseshoe. In Europe, this is a superstitious item, allegedly preventing evil spirits to enter the house. And a scientist friend visiting him told me, wait a minute, you are a scientist, you shouldn't be superstitious. Why do you have that horseshoe there? You cannot beat Niels Bohr. You know what was his answer? I know, I don't believe in it, I'm a scientist, but I have it there because I was told that it works even if you don't believe it. That's how this is ideology today. In what sense? Now you will say, I'm telling you a joke. Oh, let's go further. First, I'm saying this is what Jacques Lacan means by the idea. In late Lacan, he liked to repeat that the formula of true atheism is not God is dead, but God is unconscious. It means precisely that. For example, in psychoanalysis, today patients are cynical. You know that Freudian standard joke, this is not my mother. When you ask a patient, who is that woman in your dream? And he answers, I don't know who that woman is. I'm just sure that it's not my mother. Well, today we don't have patients like that. A patient today would probably immediately told you almost the opposite, like, I don't know who that woman is in my dream, but I trust you. Probably it has something to do with my mother or whatever. So the point is not to... The true, to put it in this metaphoric terms, the true task of psychoanalysis is not to convince you about your unconscious desires, whatever, but to convince the chicken, which is your unconscious. It's much more difficult. You know who knew this, although I'm very critical towards a lot of his work? Marx. What Marx meant by commodity fetishism is something much more mysterious than it may appear. Look how Marx begins his famous subchapter to the supplement, subdivision 4 of the chapter out of Capital on commodity fetishism. I quote Marx. A commodity appears at first sight an extremely obvious, trivial thing, but its analysis brings out that it is a very strange thing, abounding in metaphysical subtleties and theological niceties. End of quote. Are we aware what a strange thing Marx is saying here? It's the exact opposite of the naive, materialist, enlightened critique of religion, which says, oh, you, I'm simplifying it, you idiot, you live in your obscure religious fantasies. No, but in reality, no, Marx is saying the opposite. You think a commodity is just an ordinary object there. You think money is just an instrument for us exchanging commodities. But what has to be brought out is precisely the implicit metaphysical topics that you practice even if you do not believe in it. In other words, even if you are an atheist, your unconscious remain divine. Which is why when Marx provides his definition of ideology, sie wissen das nicht, aber sie tun es. They don't know it, but they are doing it. Yeah. It doesn't mean the vulgarity. Oh, you think one thing, but you are doing another thing. It means you do not know the illusions that you follow, but you are doing them. Like, to put it in simple terms, in your self-consciousness, you are a vulgar materialist, like utilitarian. You think money is just an object, blah, blah, blah. But what you are not aware is that in your social practice, you act as if you believe in magical properties, in money. And commodities are here chicken. Marx evokes this idea when he says, if commodities could speak, they would say this and so on and so on. It's this weird fiction of commodities speaking to another. Now, so again, the point is of fetishism. Marx is not that we live in some superstitions and some naive, enlightened procedure should enable us to get rid of it. No, Marx's point is precisely that, especially in modern era, where we appear to be enlightened utilitarians, we are not aware of the theological niceties, etc., which continue to structure our life. And my friend Alenka Supančić, one of the members of my Slovene Lacanian gang, applied also this chicken joke, or Marxist joke on commodities, to God. He said, instead of lunatic asylum, imagine a revolutionary materialist society where those who still believe in God are treated like madmen and they're ideologically brainwashed. So imagine one of them being finally cured, now you know there is no God and so on, and he is released, but he comes running back and says he is scared of being punished by God. Now the teacher there tells him, teacher of materialism, but you know now that God doesn't exist. He said, I know that God is dead, but does God know it? I'm afraid that God didn't learn this news, and so on. Now, why am I mentioning this? Now I turn to my favorite theologist, the old Catholic British, Gilbert Keith Chesterton, who got this point. He said that all other religions, of course, you find in them atheists, people who don't believe in God. But he says only in Christianity you find a God who, at least for a brief moment, doesn't believe in himself. Here is this wonderful quote. When the world shook and the sun was wiped out of heaven, it was not at the crucifixion, but at the cry from the cross, the cry which confessed that God was forsaken of God. And now let the revolutionist choose a creed from all the creeds, carefully weighing all the gods of inevitable recurrence and so on, they will not find another God who has himself been in revolt. Let the atheists themselves choose a God. They will find only one divinity who ever uttered their isolation, only one religion in which God seemed for an instant to become an atheist. And I don't have time to develop it, but this is why I claim today's era is perhaps less atheist than ever. We don't believe, but we always structurally need another naive gaze, what, following Jacques Lacan, maybe I could have called the subject supposed to believe, who believes for us. Like, I'm old enough, unfortunately, I never participated in them, but to remember late 60s, 70s, sexual revolution, swinging, yeah, orgies. I had some friends who were already in middle ages, which means family, they had children, and I noticed how all of them, they were participating in orgies, blah, blah, but everything turned on how their children or parents, there always was someone who shouldn't know about it. If they were to learn that that one learns about it, it would have meant the end of it all. That's why I think, I mean, this is a total distraction, but how our era which may appear, even in sexuality, the most permissive one, and so on. As many intelligent observers, like the French Lacanian Gerard Weitzmann, they noticed how, you know, the usual dogma is who needs Freud today? We are open, we can admit all our desires. Yes, but did you notice how one, the price of this permissiveness today is that one basic insight of Freud is totally obliterated, children's sexuality. Children are again elevated into innocent beings, and child molesting is returned as the worst you can imagine, the ultimate crime. There are some other crimes, I don't have time to go into them, I don't smoke, but my wife does, and she converted me not into smoking, into believing it. How? I think it's part of the same ideology, this obsession with how dangerous smoking is. It would be nice just to follow in Hollywood who still smokes today. Basically, serial killers and Arab terrorists before they explode bombs and so on. But okay, so my point is we need another innocent one. And I'm sad to say that even a film which I up to a point liked, up to a point, Roberto Benigni, La Vita è Bella, you know, relies on this structure. We know what Auschwitz is, but in order to save the innocent child, you have to construct for him the fiction that this is just a big game, we are free to leave at any point, we want, and so on. You know, let me make a mental counterfactual mental experiment. Don't you think that it would have been a much more desperate film if you remember the last scene when they are taking Benigni to be shot at the very end, and he waves at his son? If at that point somehow his son were to let him know that he also knew it all the time, that they are in a camp, but that for the same reason as his father, he just pretended to believe him to make it easier for his father. Yeah. Because he knew that if his father were to know that... So this is my category here, which is absolutely crucial. The category of a social belief which can function as a belief even if nobody believes, even if no empirical individual believes. Now, let me go on. The reason I am fully attached, shamelessly, to so-called, I hate the term, Judeo-Christian tradition, is that I claim that this is part, this insight into the horror of God and so on, monstrosity of God, is the lesson of Judeo-Christian tradition. How? It all began with the book of, how to pronounce it, the guy who got screwed up, Job. The Book of Job. I think this is the first and maybe one of the greatest books of critique of ideology. Why? Remember what happens in it. After Job is hit by all the calamities, what happens then? Three or four theological friends come, and each of them gives him, Job, the same message. Not so much is he innocent or not, but your suffering has a deeper meaning. The first one tells him basically, even if you think you are innocent, look more deep into yourself. The other one tells him maybe God is testing you, just persist. The message is your suffering has a deeper meaning. And now comes the first shock. You know, when Jehovah, God, comes, surprisingly, he says, I simplified, what these theological friends were telling is bullshit, you, Job, were right. Your suffering has no meaning. I think that this is the first big lesson. This resistance to search for a deeper meaning when we encounter catastrophes. But then things go on. Again, I will refer to Chesterton. After getting this answer for God that he is right, Job nonetheless asks, okay, but tell me, but why then did all this happen to me? Then comes God's answer, which I claim is usually totally misread. Basically a kind of arrogant speech. Where were you? when I created all those strange creatures, monsters. Usually these lines are read as assertion of God's arrogance, in the sense of, who are you, tiny, creepy mortal, to know it? We are simply on a different level. But Chesterton, in his short essay on the Book of Job, gives, and for me it's terribly convincing, gives a totally different reading. He says that God's answer is rather something like, you think you are in trouble, but look at the world that I created. Everything is a mess in it. You are not an exception. And now you will say, I'm dreaming here. My Jewish friends provided me in my last book, blah, blah, you find the proper quotes. Do you know that in Talmud there are two passages which I call, you will immediately see why, any hall passages. You know the dream scene at the beginning of Any Hall, the movie, where Woody Allen character is debating with a guy about Marshall McLuhan theories, and then Marshall McLuhan comes and says, you know, says of course to Woody Allen, you are totally right, that guy is an idiot, he done. I'm not kidding, this is not a joke, this is the sacred text, Talmud. Two rabbis debate some theological point. The one who is losing the debate says to the other, but listen, who are we to decide? Let's call Jehovah. It happens. Jehovah, an old guy, comes, but before he even starts to talk, the other rabbi starts to shout at God, listen, old man, you did your job. You did it pretty bad, but okay, you did it. Now, beat it. We theologians have to debate some serious matter. And you know what Jehovah says? He answers, oh my God, you got me, and runs away. It's absolutely breathtaking. Now, I will probably, yes, it looks bad, so let me jump. Something that I wanted to say, how this big, I will condense this part. What I wanted to develop also is the different problems and readings of the Book of Job. The way I understand it is that the secret of Protestantism is that what predestination means, it is that you have a brutal, ignorant God who simply, without any criteria, makes decisions. So I even wanted to play it. I didn't want to. You know, the last Johnny Cash hit, The Man Comes Around. This is, for me, the best of this Protestant God. I don't like Johnny Cash as a singer, but what I like in this song is the horror of how the last judgment is portrayed. Presented. It's not, oh my God, we the righteous will stand up. It's literally like we are all lined, a man, like some police comes and you are in, you are out, you are in, you are out. I was shocked to establish that clear parallel between last judgment here and the way in his, if this is a man, Primo Levi describes what he calls selection, selectia. You know, every 2 months in concentration camp, all the inmates had to run naked in front of some SS doctor. And he just quickly took a look and quickly, yes, no, means gas chamber or you continue to survive.
And I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder. One of the four beasts saying, come and see. And I saw. And behold, a white horse. There's a man going round taking names, and he decides who to free and who to blame. Everybody won't be treated all the same. There'll be a golden ladder reaching down when the man comes around. The hairs on your arm will stand up. Terror in each sip and in each sup. Will you partake of that last offered cup, or disappear into the potter's ground? When the man comes around, hear the trumpets, hear the pipers, 100 million angels singing, multitudes are marching to the big kettle drum, voices calling, voices crying, some are born and some are dying. It's Alpha and Omega's kingdom come, and the whirlwind is in the thorn tree. The virgins are all trimming their wicks. The whirlwind is in the thorn tree. It's hard for thee to kick against the pricks. Till Armageddon, no shalom, no shalom. Then the father hen will call his chickens home. The wise men will bow down before the throne, and at his feet they'll cast their golden crowns. When the man comes around, whoever is unjust, let him be unjust still. Whoever is righteous, let him be righteous still. Whoever is filthy, let him be filthy still. Listen to the words long written down. When the man comes around, hear the trumpets, hear the pipers, 100 million angels singing, multitudes are marching to the big kettle drum, voices calling, voices crying. Some are born and some are dying. It's Alpha and Omega's kingdom come, and the whirlwind is in the thorn tree. The virgins are all trimming their wicks. The whirlwind is in the thorn tree. It's hard for thee to kick against the pricks. In measured hundredweight and penny pound, when the man comes around. And I heard a voice in the midst of the four beasts, and I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and his name that sat on him was Death. And hell followed with him.
Again, you will say, why this crazy vision of God? What has this to do? I think to arrive at what Jesus Christ means, you have to go through this. I think because what happens for me, that's my reading, which is basically Hegel's reading. What happens on the cross? It's not that God sends us a messenger and, okay, it failed, sorry. God says to Christ, come back to me, come back to your dad. I will try maybe in 1,000 years. No, as Hegel put it, what dies on the cross is the God of beyond itself. What dies on the cross is precisely this idea of God as a secret master up there who, no matter how bad things look down here on earth, he pulls the strings and guarantees that everything will end well. You know this, I find it ethically repulsive, this metaphor for God, which was usually evoked by old theologists, which is that we ordinary mortals are like one who imagine a big, classical, beautiful painting. We, with our limited view, we look too close at it, and, you know, like if you look at Mona Lisa from 1 inch, you see just a stain. But if you step back and see all of it, you see how what you misperceived as a stain contributes to harmony of it all. This God dies there. And I think that the ethical reasons are clear. Like, let's say somebody complains about Holocaust or Gulag or other things. Are you really ready to say to this guy, listen, Holocaust may appear to you as something horrible, but can't you see how it contributes to the harmony of it all, and so on and so on? The gesture of Christ is precisely a kind of a self-deposition of God. What happens of the cross is, I think, on the cross is God abdicates. God no longer believes even in himself. So what happens is Holy Spirit. Holy Spirit, which is just our freedom, the community of believers. This is, I think, again, what is the ultimate message of Christianity. It's not you are safe, because no matter how confused things are, God is up there taking care of it. No, it's God lost control. It's up to you. And even not only Chesterton, some very intelligent Catholic intellectuals saw this. For example, a conservative like Paul Claudel, whom I appreciate very much, he said that the ultimate message of Christianity is God is impotent without us. It's not we have to rely on God. It's the message of the cross is God is just a witness who relies on us. And just now, a little bit of a conclusion. So, what kind of theology can we bring out of this if at the end we just get the suffering Christ, pure, impassive compassion, and basically telling us no transcendental guarantee, no one is pulling the strings? I think that, incidentally, only with such a radical reading can you really give, I don't have time to go into this now, of course, a consistent interpretation of all those problematic passages in the Bible. You know, this is my long tradition. For example, in Vienna and Munich, I had a debate even with some bishops, and I asked them these totally simple questions. For example, when God says, if you don't hate your mother, your father, you are not my follower, what does this mean? It's incredible what answers I got. If we were to be in medieval times, I would have burned them all. One of them, a bishop, told me, God just meant don't be excessive in your earthly loves. Reserve the true love for me. I find this disgusting and horrible. As if God is some jealous master who say, okay, love that woman a little bit. Just I want to be sure that you love me more. I think it's exactly the opposite. In Christianity, you don't have to love God. God is love. God is here when you passionately love someone, and so on and so on. If we are in this universe, which is radically atheist, it's not only that you think there is no God. Also, you don't have this unconscious God as the appearance on which you rely. What remains of religion? Here, if you allow me just some good 5 minutes to conclude, I would like to quote a guy whom I'm honored to call my friend, the ex-Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, who is not an idiot. He's not a total idiot. And I mean this sincerely. There are two types of people, total idiots and not total idiots. There is no third option. Commenting on the work of 4 British Catholic novelists, O'Connor, Percy, Spark, and Ellis, Rowan Williams wrote, I quote, all four, these 4 writers, create a world in which the secular majority account of what is going on is severely relativized. But there is no simple alternative that anyone can step into by a single decision or even a series of decisions. The religious dimension of these fictions lies in the insistent sense of incongruity, unmistakable even if no one within the fiction can say what we should be congruent with, end of quote. So the term negative theology is here meant in a much more radical sense than usually, where the idea is simply God is so much beyond that all of our positive determinations fail. That the idea is rather that that we locate negativity into God itself, that it is as if God as a positive entity fills in a certain negative place which precedes divinity, which is precisely the place of that what in my Hegelianism I would have called negativity, this basic feeling of being out of joint and so on and so on, which I think precedes any positive transcendence. In this sense, I'm not playing cheap paradoxical game that I say that theology for me as an atheist can survive. Religion is no longer the opium of the people today because if for no other reasons than, and I like this well-known saying, that today the opium of the people is more and more simply opium itself, drugs and so on. But this, and here I also think we should do two things. First, this is, I think that we should reject not only evolutionary materialists like Richard Dawkins and so on and so on. I mean, now I will be paradoxical here. Maybe all that Dawkins is describing is at some stupid factual level true. But still, he totally doesn't get the point of religion. It's simply not, even if it's true. And this is my position of negativity here. Another thing, I think we should also reject, I don't have time to go into it now, but I think we should also reject all this, how should I call it, what is usually referred to today as a new materialism, this re-enchantment of reality as immanently spiritualized. What I ironically like to call the Hobbit or Lord of the Rings materialism. Because did you notice that in Lord of the Rings universe, there are no gods. All the magic is material magic. You have magical beings, this, that, but there is no other dimension. It's a fully self-enclosed, spiritualized universe. I think that we have to keep alive precisely this sense of radical out-of-jointness. To, just now, the last 2-3 minutes, just to make this clear, and in your spirit, I would like also, if you began with Vertigo, I would like much more modestly to end with one of the most disturbing TV episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Present, the early ones, 25 minutes. They are now republishing them. It's the one called The Glass Eye, the opening episode of the third year, where Jessica Tandy, incidentally, this is, if you are like the two of us, Hitchcockologists, she is a crucial actress. On the one hand, she is the mother in The Birds.
Oh, yeah.
But at the same time, you know, for what I perceive as maybe the greatest Beckett play, the not I, which is really a partial object talking, the mouth. She was there. She was the original. Okay. She plays a lone woman who falls in love with a handsome ventriloquist, Max Collodi, the obvious reference to Pinocchio. So every evening he performs in a small cabaret. She's there in the first row observing him, how he manipulates, you know, ventriloquism. Then comes, I was even shocked. I didn't expect this. Then the last evening, it's his last performance, she gathers the courage and approaches him while the people are leaving there on stage and touches him like, hi, look at me, no? And can you imagine what happens? She discovers the big guy collapses as a doll. She discovers that the truly living being is the doll, the small one, that there is a midget in there, and that the truly manipulated one was the big one, you know. And then out of that costume, steps out a dwarf, totally desperate, and starts to cry and runs away and so on and so on. So what I'm saying is that, again, the result is that the ventriloquist was, in fact, the dummy, while the hideous dummy is the actual ventriloquist. And what I claim is that God is dead means something similar, that we have to abandon the common notion of Christ as God who is the Father's puppet. No, the Christian reversal is something like this. Forget about God the Father, he was just a big fat dead doll. All that is alive is Christ there, and love that, accept that. So again, my point is, I will develop this in my next book much more in detail, but my point is, and I hope we agree here, that I don't like to bluff here. I'm not playing those games that Jürgen Habermas is now playing. Oh, I'm an agnostic. Maybe God exists, maybe not. No, I am an atheist. But I think that without this, that my paradox would be this one. Only by going through Christianity, you can be, in this sense, a radical atheist. Without this authentic theological experience of out of joint, of this world we are in is not it, you, even if you pretend to be a materialist, you end up as some kind of a cheap, perverted spiritualist. This is why it's easy to prove, for example, how Stalinism is immanently, but in a perverted way, theological. Because, you know, the whole position of a Stalinist communist is the position of an instrument of some big other, historical necessity and so on. Like, I am not myself, I am an instrument of, and so on and so on. This is why I claim here, as a Hegelian, that in what sense does God give us freedom? Let's say you find yourself... Okay, I'll put it like this, just to conclude. Let's say you find yourself in a position where you feel, experience yourself as abandoned by God. Oh, God is out there, I'm alone, and so on. All other religions offer you the path of reconciliation. Weep yourself a little bit more good deeds, suffer, and maybe you will be able to rejoin God. The answer of Christianity is a totally different one. It is precisely when you feel totally abandoned by God, you are in the position of Christ. That's to say, who on the cross is, you know, Father, why have you abandoned me, and so on. So in other words, the very gap that separates you from God is an inner self-separation of God himself. Your distance from God is part of divinity. Which is why I think that's the good news of New Testament. The good news are not, oh, God Father is there. No, the good news are, in a Hegelian way, if I put it, exactly the same as the bad news. The bad news is we are alone, no God will take care of us. And the good news is wonderful, so we are free. This loneliness is which succeeds self-erasure was, is precisely freedom. And that's the fundamental insight of Christianity, which is, I wonder if you will agree here, which is extremely important even politically today. Which is why, against political correctness, I'm totally opposed to this idea that global capitalism, secular, and then we can resuscitate some stupid local traditions, you know, like Brazilian friends try to convince me that there are some tribes in lower Amazon which has some primordial wisdom, whatever, how you are, we don't just... My point is this one. I'm here on the side of Malcolm X. You know, What I disagree with many things that he wrote, but one thing was a stroke of a genius. X. This is not a simple complaint, oh, bad white people deprived us blacks of our authentic roots. No, what Malcolm X saw is that this X, which means we have no hierarchic roots in tradition, we cannot trace our roots, that this horror that white people did to us is at the same time a unique chance of freedom to be more universalist than white people together. He saw this. And this is so important today, I think. We cannot fight. I think global imperialism, whatever we call it, is inherently multicultural. You don't fight it by sticking to your law. This is typical global capitalist subject. It's not the one who eats hamburgers, but it's the one who works for a big company, and then if you're a Buddhist, you do your meditation. If you're a Hindu, you do your sacrifices, whatever. All this fits perfectly global capitalism. The problem is to beat it with even stronger globalism. I'm very sorry if I used too much time, but that's it. Thank you very much.
Right. That was the Union of Time Thieves. That was Slavoj Žižek. Nothing you hear tonight will compete with that. But, as you know, here at the Sudden Radio Project, we like Mahmoud Darwish, Palestinian poet, and he says, "I am not mine." This is from the expropriated poet. To the reader, do not trust the poem. The daughter of absence is neither intuition nor is it thought, but rather the sense of the abyss. Darwish, I am there. I came from there, and remember, I was born like everyone is born. I have a mother and a house with many widows. I have brothers, friends, and a prison. I have a wave that seagulls snatched away. I have a view of my own and an extra blade of grass. I have a moon past the peak of words. I have God-sent food of birds and an olive tree beyond the Kent of time. I have traversed the land before swords turned bodies into banquets. I came from there. I returned the sky to its mother. For when its mother, the sky cries, and I weep for a returning cloud to know me. I have learned the words of blood-stained courts in order to break the rules. I have learned and dismantled all the words to construct a single one. Home. And now it's time for the Sudden Radio Project. It's 11 o'clock. This is KBOO.FM. Get up, pour yourself another glass of vodka, and lie back down. Turn the lights out, and for God's sake, listen.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Dr. Milo Hyoid of the SRP Institute of Audition. Have you ever wondered, how do the amazing radio theater artists of the Sudden Radio Project produce such wonderful and affecting tones with their voices? Believe it or not, they create those splendid sounds in the same way you and I do, through a process speech specialists call phonation. What happens during phonation, you ask? Let's climb down the throat of a Sudden Radio cast member and find out. Ah, here's Randall Howington. Hello, Randall.
Hey, Doc.